You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, we're talking with Sarah Medway. She's a painter, and we're talking to her from London. Sarah, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thank you, Brainerd, and thank you for giving me this opportunity to consider and to think about my work and to sort of attempt to put into words what is predominantly for me an intuitive and a visual process. So I'm very grateful that I'm having to give it thought. Thank you.
And where are you now? Are you in London?
Yes, I'm actually calling from my loft. I have a loft by the canal. I love water. I was born by the sea. Water is often in my work, or the idea of water. And my studio is actually about a 10-minute walk, which is fantastic. It's easy, it's practical, and it's in Hoxton, which is a very lively, creative area in London. It's a very exciting area, actually. So I work in my studio. I obviously don't work from home, but this is a better phone to speak to you. I've got a really ancient phone in the studio.
And what are you working on right now in the studio? What's the current...
Well, at the moment, I'm working on a series of dark paintings. I'd like to kind of try and describe them.
Sure.
Sometimes I like the square format. I don't tend to work on, although my passion is the natural world and landscape, I don't use landscape format, which is horizontal. So I like the democracy of the square and its neutrality, so no one side is dominating. And so at the moment I'm working on a series of dark paintings. Usually I start by painting a particular black on the base of the canvas from edge to edge. And it can be warm black or cool black, lamp black directly from a tube, or a black that I mix. I like particularly French ultramarine and burnt umber. It makes a wonderful black.
Mm.
And then I have to let that dry. It's oil, so it takes a week. And then I start to paint light on the dark. But sometimes I reverse the process and I have a light base color, and then I add the dark onto the light. When I think about this, I actually see painting light onto the dark as a more optimistic way of painting, rather than painting the dark onto the light, which I think feel is more pessimistic. So it would be more often that I paint the light onto the dark base.
But that's very interesting. When you talk about pessimistic or optimistic, you're talking about the process seems pessimistic or optimistic, or that is the result of the content in some way? Because that's a very interesting way to talk about.
I think the content. Mm. Yes. I think maybe the content, Brainerd. That's an interesting question, actually. I think it's the content, because I know Turner, who I admire greatly, always painted looking into the light. You know, he said the sun is God. And he would have the yellow at the back of the base of the canvas would be the yellow, or there'd be this really fervid disc of the sun. And then he would paint on that. Whereas mm-hmm. Constable always painted with the sun above him, overhead. And I think I'm sort of more with Turner in a way. But I also feel that when I'm painting, for instance, I ask myself the question, how dark can I make a painting about light? Because I'm interested in polarities. And without the dark, there is no light. And polarities is very much in my work, this idea of polarities, some more dominant than others. And one particularly dominant is dark and light. So I think, how dark can I actually make a painting about light?
So that would
but
be
I don't know why.
Like,
I just feel
like dark matter would be an example of that, as opposed to energy field. I'm referencing two paintings.
Absolutely. Yes. Absolutely. Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And also the idea of the black, for instance, or the one color, is macro, because that again is a polarity. The macro, the large mark. So this covering of the whole canvas, which I'm doing at the moment, this series of dark paintings, I see that as the macro, the large mark. And this large mark is going, I see it as going on beyond the edges of the canvas. So I always feel that my canvas is a part of something larger. They're just a section of something larger. And then when that is ready, I deploy a disciplined process which relies on a sort of measured continuity of slow actions. I'm not a fast painter, I'm a slow painter. Mm. And that is the micro, that the small mark, the non, but they're non-gestural. They're slow and they're repetitions of small marks, tashes, sort of finger-sized, brush-sized shapes of paint. And these sort of marks are controlled, and I shape them sort of from the outside in, which means I give a shape to the mark I'm making with the brush, for instance, into ovals or beads of light, they're organic. I see those as organic. And sometimes I paint a more hard-edged mark, which is more geometric. Again, that's a polarity, the organic and the geometric. So I don't just put down a mark, I actually shape it.
Is that how something in like the painting energy field, which may be imaged in this, or people can look at your website, that tends to look very organic, like we're almost looking at something biological? They don't quite look like what we would think of as painterly marks. They look like kind of ovals and squares that have hard edges, almost like cells or cell structures of some kind.
Yeah, very much. That's very perceptive. Yes, Brainard, absolutely. They are, in fact, the base of that painting was so colorful. I was on a journey of discovery. I never know how my paintings are going to evolve. It's risky. It's scary sometimes. And I had used so many colors because I don't have a fear of color. I think some artists actually have a fear of color. But it was so much color, I thought, oh my God, this is just, I've got to do something. It's not working compositionally. And then I started making marks, but I used eventually the felt tip pen, which I had to give up because it's a big painting. It's 6 foot square, 183 centimeters square. And around each felt tip mark, I went round about five or six times around each mark because I wasn't satisfied with the depth of the color black. And I got a repetitive strain injury in the end, and I had to go to the physiotherapist because it was so challenging to make that painting, but I felt it worked then. It worked. All that color, somehow I was able to subdue or rein in by making those marks. But I thought, I can't do this too often because it's almost driven me crazy and mad with you know, the hours and the constantly using this felt tip on this very large canvas. But it was interesting. It was an interesting exercise, and I actually did similar work on smaller 2 foot canvases. You know, that was sort of more manageable.
Well, you said you were
Whereas
making
now
a,
at the moment,
an exploration. That I'm sorry to interrupt, but you said you were making an exploration then too, and talking about a kind of fear of color, which you don't have, but I relate to. I also, you know, am an artist and produced visual work for the longest time that was black and white. You know, it was printmaking, monoprints, and I remember to this day being afraid of color and trying to find out a way into it where I could use it. But I think that's not uncommon with artists, this kind of fear of using a lot of colors, which energy field has.
Yes, it has more color than any other painting I think I've done. I'd love to see your work, Brainard, at some point. But when you think of color, if you think of an amazing colorist, Odilon Redon, who did a lot of pastel work, he was remarkable with color. They sing, they hum, they're amazing. But he had a period, and I'm not sure how long, I think even a decade, when he only made black. I think he only used black pastel. I mean, they're beautiful, stunning, because there's many blacks. But I think for a decade, he only worked with black. And then suddenly, he discovered the color, and the color was remarkable after having that sort of decade of not using it.
Yeah, I don't know if that was, you know, what Ed Reinhardt did, too. At the beginning, when you were talking about using as much black as possible, I thought of a painter like Ed Reinhardt, who's, you know, this kind of blacks on blacks on blacks, and eventually did go to a color, but I think he spent a long time on
yes.
a series of black paintings as well.
And Malevich's Black Square.
Hmm.
I mean, people said painting is dead after that. You know, there's the black square, that's it. But it doesn't seem to be dead. It's quite, you know, robust, really.
Yes, it is.
And, but I like this idea of polarity. So when I make these marks, some are vertical, which energize the painting, and some are horizontal, which seems to calm the painting.
Mm.
And this series of paintings in the studio, well, again, I love repetition. I like the idea of repetition and reiteration.
But you said you don't know where your paintings are going. If I'm understanding correctly, that when you begin a painting, you're not sure what the composition or outcome or palette will be. Is that the case?
Yes, that's true. But often one paint, that's very true, but often when one painting comes out of another, there's a progression, and they're kind of coming out of the one before and the one before and the one before. And sometimes if I ever get into a state of knowing being too knowing at the beginning of my paintings and thinking I'm going to do this, that, and the other, the willed paintings are never as interesting as the ones where I'm wrestling with doubt, struggling sometimes, wiping off, you know, sometimes 6 hours of painting with oil, then thinking it's okay, going home, coming back to the studio the next day and thinking, oh, God, you know, that's terrible, and wiping it all off with a rag and thinking I've wasted 2 days with this. But it's not really a waste because I'm learning and I'm moving on and I'm discovering. So I think, you see, my work is not processed-based abstraction because I don't want answers up front. I don't want to think I'm going to do this, that, and the other, because then it's sort of, okay, it's a lot less risky and scary in some ways, but I prefer to be on this sort of journey of exploration and discovery.
Well, but the journey, as you're saying, or as I understood what you just said, is also kind of a dialogue with each painting to some extent, right? As one, you say, kind of leads into the other. It's perhaps,
yes.
And just stop me if I'm overreaching, but speaking or having a conversation a bit with the last one because that's where you left off or where your last
yes.
exploration was.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's absolutely it. They're sort of coming out of the last one, and then I move on to the next one. And then slowly, sometimes the language changes. But, I mean, in the current paintings, which have come out of I did a very big commission of 56 oil paintings, and I was thought, oh, my God, how am I going to do this in a year? And I was in the studio often 7 days. But
I want to hear about the approach to that, but that's a kind of extraordinary commission. Can you just explain what kind of commission that is, a commission for 50 or 60 oil paintings that are also quite large? Is that correct?
Well, do I say who I did it for or do I not mention?
You can if you want. Either way, yeah, it's fine to mention who you did it for.
Well, it was for a cruise company that have a huge cruise ship that was launched by Her Majesty the Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh on the 10th of March last year. And there were other artists and ceramicists and people doing little sculptural bronzes. And I was asked to do, I was picked because my work is abstract. They wanted abstract work, but they wanted somebody who was abstracting from nature. I mean, I'm not abstracting from the body or from a metropolis or the cityscape, not usually anyway. And so they liked the fact that it's sort of about, in a way, the sky and navigation and night sky and water, and as you could read it, but resolutely abstract, but coming out of nature. And so I had to paint 56 paintings, and I was then able to see them on the aft of the ship, and it was very interesting. So I had a real sense of continuity of those 56. You know, and now the current work is sort of coming out of some of the darker paintings for that particular commission.
And those 50, those paintings were all quite large. Those were all approximately 5 by 5 feet. Is that how large they were for the commission?
Thank God they weren't. There were about 9 5-foot, and there were only 3 6-foot, the largest, and then they were basically 70 centimeters square. I was glad it was the square, and they wanted the square, and they were predominantly, mainly, you know, 70 centimeters, which is, I think, 2'4", and that was good, because I don't think I could have coped with doing sort of 56 really large ones in a year. I'd have needed a couple of years as a slow worker and working with oil. But
I interrupted you when you were talking about how you approach that commission, because that seems kind of extraordinary for a painter to have a commission like that. Was that the largest you've ever had?
I've never had one that size before. I mean, I didn't even know if I could do it. I was really quite at the beginning I started sort of very quickly, and I suffered from that because I can't work like that. And the canvases they gave me were not on wooden stretchers, they were on metal, on aluminium stretchers, because obviously with the sea and the you know, the wet, and they needed to be on sort of museum quality strong stretchers. And so I was given the 56 into my studio, and by rather rushing myself, I was not happy with the first 15, and I had to repaint them. Once I got sort of into my zone of work, kind of zen place or whatever you'd call it, and I then looked back on the early ones and thought, these don't work, and they're not working with this body of work, and I had to repaint them. So it was actually 70 paintings, but it was great because
incredible.
It's fantastic because it made me work harder than I've ever worked. I mean, I work hard, but I usually have the weekends off, or half a day Saturday. But I had to work 7 days a week and long hours, and so that was very good. It was challenging, but it was also very interesting for the work. And so the current work, you see, is coming from, as it's the dark paintings, they're sort of coming from this, from the work that I did for that commission. And so really, I suppose, I'm trying to describe what they're like. As I like this sort of repetition and reiteration of this thing of, you know, repeated mark, I believe that the repeated mark, if it's a single mark, or if you have the repeated mark, the repeated mark intensifies the image, the composition of the painting, you know. And so at the moment I would say that these marks I'm making become sort of a part of a universe of micro marks, little marks, which are like cells, just as you said, cells, stars, chains of light, in a sort of infinity of darkness or an infinity of color. So in a way it may sound like I'm sort of painting a night sky, and some people may read it as that. But I hope these paintings sort of offer a space where the viewer can, they can sort of find their own story of imagination within the painting. because I'm not offering a narrative.
Right. Some of them seems to be, and perhaps this relates a little bit to the commission. But as you were saying before, some of them seem almost like landscapes, like seascapes, where others seem a little bit like a night sky. There is no horizon, and it seems infinite. Kind of this gazing structure. Is that two different ways of approaching, or do you see them all one way or the other?
How do you mean,
I mean landscapes as opposed to, like, as you were just talking, it made me think, yes, this, when there is no, for there not to be an imposed narrative on it, there, what struck me immediately was the work that, to me, looks like it has no horizon and no references to say something like a landscape. As you were saying, that when they commissioned the other paintings, they were thinking of you as a painter who did a, who perhaps drew from nature, and some I'm saying have more references to that than others. And I was just wondering whether what you were talking about were the paintings that seem to have no reference at all to land or a horizon.
I mean, the ones I did for this commission, which I sort of called Voyage, because it was about the idea of the voyage at sea, but also it was a metaphor for the voyage of life with all its light and shade and darkness and joy. And I was sort of thinking about the idea of voyage, and that maybe fed into the work that I did for the commission. But now I feel when I'm in the studio in Hoxton, I tend to work more from within, because I'm in this crazy sort of noisy city, in a very interesting area, my studio, because they've actually just discovered the archaeological dig behind my studio, the Museum of London, have just discovered where Shakespeare first showed Romeo and Juliet. And they're going to have an open-air stage there, and they're developing it. So I'm in a very creative, interesting place.
But where is that, where they just discovered that? I haven't read that in the news.
It's Shoreditch. It's going to be called The Stage. At Shoreditch, the stage is the development, and they're going to build a stage. And the Museum of London, at the moment, they're finding archaeological artifacts. It will take 2 or 3 years, and it's going to be a lot of noise just behind.
But this is very close to your studio as well.
Very close, yes. And so that is a wonderful sort of creative place. But not only that, every day when I walk to work, I am confronted with the most amazing young artists who make graffiti art. There is a huge amount in Shoreditch and Hoxton as well, right next to my studio, of walls where there's this constantly changing wonderful series of different artists and working different types of graffiti art, and I always enjoy that very much as well. But yet, when I get into the studio, I think my studio in London is where I'm most going within myself, most creating, sort of going into an inner world, which is really away from all the noise and the metropolis. And yet, if I paint in Spain, where I have a small studio, I'm looking at the landscape, I'm looking out of myself more at the landscape and processing all these sensuous, beautiful things that I see.
That's very interesting. So wait a minute, to interrupt. So you're talking about, and just correct me if I'm wrong, kind of the studio and the space of the studio, in a sense, dictating whether some of the paintings are entirely abstract, meaning without narrative and without references to horizon or landscape, whereas in another studio there may be more references to landscape and not this kind of undefined plane.
Yes.
That's fascinating.
Yes, because if I think about three places, for instance, I worked, Hoxton, you know, is where I'm really going within, as I say, and I'm painting more from memory and imagination, and I'm looking inward. But of course, my passion is nature, and at art school, I spend a lot of time drawing in the landscape. when I was developing my abstract language, it began for at least over a year, year and a half of just making representational drawings of landscape. So in the studio, it's more going within. But if I'm in Spain, it's so beautiful, the landscape and the light and the color, the sounds of birds and bees, which I don't get really in Hoxton, the plants, the flowers, trees, it all somehow gets processed, all these sensuous influences. And the paintings I've done in Spain would never have been painted in Hoxton. Although they're abstract, they're not a rendition of the wildflowers, but they're inspired by the wildflowers or the light, or it's sort of
and where in Spain is that? Do you mind me asking where in Spain is that?
It's in Andalusia. It's southern Spain. It's about an hour from Malaga Airport, and it's in the Axarquía Mountains. So it's very quite primitive. There's eagles and there's goats in the riverbed. And everywhere you look, there are wonderful sort of patchworks of olive trees, almond trees.
Oh my God, that sounds incredible! You're in a little village. That's way outside the city. It's extremely rural there, isn't it?
Very rural, and we look over the riverbed, and then we look up to a rocks where the eagles fly, and there's a little white town with a small white houses some distance away. And it's very interesting working there, and I work more in London. I mean, I'm in Spain less than London because my work is really here. But I find it very interesting, you know, these two ways of working, and it does feed into the work, although it's abstract. I could never make the Spanish paintings in Hoxton any more than I could make the Hoxton paintings in Spain. And one other sort of example of... Sorry?
No, go on, yeah. One of the examples?
No, I was just going to say one other example of where I worked, because you're in the States, and I love New York, and I love America. But I worked the Triangle Artist Workshop in 1998. I was one of... 22 artists from 11 countries, and we worked in the North Tower on the 91st floor of the World Trade Center. And I thought, my goodness, you know, you have to change your normal studio practice. And mine, of course, in Hoxton is looking sort of within. And I looked out of that incredible view, that amazing view. I feel privileged, actually, to have been there for 2 weeks, really privileged. And you know, helicopters flying beneath you, and this incredible bulk and mass of this seething mass of metropolis. And I started drawing sort of the grid was great, of course, you know, because I like the polarity of vertical and horizontal. I started drawing the grid, and then I made two very large quite large paintings, 5 foot square, of New York day and New York night, and it's exactly the same view. October 98, when the sun was shining, and you know, you can see the Empire State Building opposite, and there's all these roads and the rivers and bridges. And I then did the same painting, a night painting, because again, it's this thing of the enjoying the polarity of things. So it was New York day, and then the same view at night when the city was, you know, these amazing lit windows and the cars, I think it was Broadway, where the cars, all these sort of bright red taillights, chains of red lights, and the windows, the warm yellows and the cool yellows. It's like a jeweled city. So it was the same view, but day and night. And those paintings could never have been made in London or Spain. I mean, they are inherent with the sort of things that I was looking at. I did look more outward, you see. I looked at that incredible view.
Right.
And I was making more referential work in a way by looking at something.
I'm so glad you mentioned that and the New York view, because I know that view too, or I did know that view. It was quite extraordinary. And I wanted to ask you, I think in closing the interview, a little bit about what you said earlier about painting, you know, not being dead as was thought after the Malevich painting, but in fact quite robust. how do you see it as robust? And I know that it is. I certainly have interviewed other painters and artists. And it's interesting, though, because sometimes you hear from some artists that, you know, they don't see much painting. Everything seems to be, you know, research or conceptual based or something. So what do you mean by robust, and why do you see it as robust?
Well, first of all, I think the art world is a very big place, and there's room in the art world for all types of work. I've been to art fairs in the past, Frieze or different places, where photography was, like, predominant. And then recently going to Frieze in London, I was really happy to see a sort of resurgence of paintings. I think there's lots of young people who are making really interesting paintings coming out of art school. So each artist has a unique vision. So we're not really repeating ourselves. You know, we all have our particular way of doing something. And it's very difficult for me to describe this in a way, because for me, art is almost easier to experience than to explain.
Well, it is, and I agree it is, but in terms of, you know, just the young work you're seeing or older work you're seeing, and the idea of painting being something that's robust, as you're saying, as opposed to the opposite, as opposed to it being this sort of formalist notion, you know, that perhaps was being proposed around the time of Malevich or you know, even other painters, that now, as you're saying, the art world has room for everyone, but also
yes,
painting is highly valued, it seems, not in
alive
financial
and
terms.
Kicking.
It's alive and kicking.
It's alive and kicking. Well, I'm glad that it's alive and kicking, because I've seen some remarkable paintings in my time. The paintings made me laugh. Paintings have made me cry. I mean, a painting that made me laugh was Pollock. I had to write an essay about Pollock once, and I didn't rate him. And stubborn as I am, I actually changed my opinion completely after studying his work, and just loved the work. But there was an early painting called The Stenographer. And it's like almost like a female with this bloodshot eye, and her hands are flailing about, typing. And she's got this bloodshot eye, and it reminded me when I was learning to type and working for somebody, and I got this sort of migraine, and my hands were flying about over this typewriter, and I just laughed my head off. And I thought, thank you, Pollock. Thank you, Jackson Pollock, because you've made me laugh in front of a painting. I connected with it. And you can see another painting. You know, I love Klimt. I'm a great fan of his, particularly when I talk about liking repetition, his wonderful woods, his paintings of the landscape rather than his paintings of women. But those incredible woods with pine trees, with, you know, repetitions of trunks or silver birches. And I went to the Royal Academy and I saw a painting by him. And I was a bit sort of not enjoying much of the work, and I suddenly saw this incredible painting called The Large Poplar. It's a huge, on the right-hand side, such a remarkable composition, very interesting composition, radical in a way, with a very low horizon line, and on the right-hand side, a large poplar tree where you have a lot of small marks. And then this amazing, the rest of the canvas is this amazing, moody sky, but with a lot of nuances under the sky. Sort of moody, caput mortem, sort of purpley. I don't know how exactly to describe it. And just this composition, I stood looking at it for like 15 minutes and thinking, I've seen it in a book, but God, this is an amazing painting. Mm. So I feel that there's always going to be people coming up, young artists who look at others. I mean, that's how we learn. When I was at art school, you know, I went into the landscape and drew, and then I started looking at people like Klimt, Monet, when I think of his poplar trees on the River Ept. Early Mondrian I looked at. I very much like Mondrian with his trees and his water, you know, which eventually become very, again, abstracted into the vertical and the horizontal. So I looked at a lot of these artists, and then I started to develop my own language and my own vocabulary. particularly with this interest of polarities, you know, darkness and light and macro, micro, Apollonian, Dionysian, motion and rest, but not motion and rest in the city necessarily, motion and rest in nature, in landscape. I read the nature poets, Ralph Waldo Emerson, I love his essay on nature, and Henry Thoreau, who, you know, had that experiment at Walden Pond. And I sort of read them, and I have listened to landscape music and classical music. So I have these sort of influences as I was developing my language from being working representationally in the landscape to being, you know, more of an abstract painter. Although I still do draw, I mean, I do draw on Hampstead Heath, or I draw, you know, when I was in New York, I was drawing. And I can draw representationally, but my landscapes are always empty of people. They're just really looking at nature.
And are there any shows upcoming? Is there anywhere we should tell the listeners to, or point them to? Because people are in different parts of the world that listen to this. Are there any upcoming exhibitions that you're having that we should know about? There will be links in this interview to other things, but anywhere you want to point
at the moment,
to?
I'm just not. Sorry.
No, just
at
anywhere
the moment,
you want.
I'm just
point
working.
To.
Well, I've done a few commissions that have sort of private commissions in the, you know, the last few months for different art consultants and people. But at the moment, I'm just the series of work at the moment is not going to be shown anywhere in particular per se. I'm just working on something that sort of interests me and has come out of the, you know, the commission, the sort of progression of the work I was doing before. So at the moment, nothing that I can say except that I have a book that came out, a monograph that came out last summer. And the monograph is just my name, Sarah Medway, and it's called Voyage. And it's actually the 56 oil paintings that I did for the commission. And there's a couple of very good essays in there by two art critics, Andrew Lambeth, who's written about my work for 20 years, and he sort of put it in context. And another very good writer, Sue Hubbard, who's a poet and a critic, and she wrote an essay as well. So that's the sort of thing that's sort of current.
Okay, that is good. And if is it possible to, if I wanted to see your work on that ship, how do you identify that ship so that... if I wanted, I could see the work on it. Yeah,
well,
isn't that how else would we find it? Yeah.
Well, yes, you're right. Yeah. The name is the P&O. It's P&O, and it's the Britannia, which was obviously the Queen had a royal yacht called Britannia, but that was decommissioned. And so it's the Britannia. It's very large. It's 22 decks, very modern, very glamorous. And usually it goes to New York, and it will go, you know, all around Europe and to the north where it's cold, and to the Mediterranean. And so if any of your listeners were going on a cruise, the Britannia, my paintings are in the aft of the ship as you go up and down the levels. And they can see them there, and also actually in the bookshop they have my monograph on the boat. So there are, and of course it's on Amazon.
Well, that's exciting. That makes me want to go on that cruise on the Britannia, and I smile just thinking about that. It sounds wonderful and interesting that the work is there. Sarah, we were talking a bit off the record about the blank canvas, and exactly what were you going to say about that?
Oh, it was just a brilliant quote by Kandinsky, because, you know, the complexity of creating work over a sustained period of years is difficult, as you know as well. It takes time. There are periods of gestation, of silence, of inactivity and melancholy when nothing seems to work. And there is always this problem of the blank canvas. And I love this quote by Kandinsky. He says, empty canvas in appearance, really empty, silent, indifferent, stunned almost, in effect, full of tensions, with a thousand subdued voices, heavy with expectations, a little frightened it may be violated. I think that's a great quote.
I love that. Thank you for sharing that with me and the listeners. And thank you for talking with me today, Sarah.
It's been a pleasure, Brainard. Thank you.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.